The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. Hope you had a nice day today. Another day in this world of ours that leaves a lot of us just scratching our heads. How much longer can it go on like this? Well, it's not going to go on like this much longer because it's in a constant change, a state of flux. And where it's fluxing to ain't very good, as most of you well realize. We have a really, really interesting first hour. Well, the whole program tonight will be fascinating, but this is very special. In the world of ufology, there are people who have had extraordinary experiences, who have, for one reason or another, and there are quite a few different reasons, kept their experiences secret or private for a long time. And some of those people now have decided that it is time to share what they went through. It doesn't do any good if you take it with you. And I'm so grateful when these things happen. With us tonight is George Filer, our Filer's Files regular. George is on once a month and introduced us to Frank Chile, who is on as well. George, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Where are you, George? Did you go home?
Beautiful New Jersey at 40 degrees and chilly and snow on the ground.
The snow?
But, right. I just got back from Florida. I like it better down there, at least this time of year.
George is snowbird of the year, I think. Isn't that what it is?
Right.
Something like that. Okay. Some time ago, George introduced me and all of you folks to Frank Chile. And Frank has shared many fascinating visits with us, things that he has experienced and seen, and also has introduced us to some other folks who have unusual stories to tell. Welcome back, Frank. How are you?
Very good, Jeff. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience again this evening.
Oh, thank you. I'm really honored to have you back, and doubly so because you have a friend, you have many friends, but you've got a friend whose name is Dan. And Dan is going to come on and join us here in just a minute or two. Dan is one of these people who has extraordinary experiences and who has kept them private. I won't say secret. I don't like that word. Private for a long time. How did you meet Dan, and what are we going to hear? Don't give us the specifics. We don't want to ruin it. But just in general terms, what are the parameters of his experiences?
Well, Jeff, I met Dan, I'd say, probably 15 years ago through a mutual friend that I've known for probably 40, maybe 45 years now. And she said, Frank, I have a friend who had some extraordinary experiences, and knowing that you're interested in UFOs and that whole field, I think it would be good if you and Dan could get a chance to meet and she had us over for dinner, and Dan and his wife was there. We had a lovely dinner, and Dan shared some extraordinary stories with me of what he had experienced when he was at a naval base, uh-huh. at a facility where you're not supposed to have a naval base. Or
oh, really?
No one would think that there would be a naval base, yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, Frank, you would mention that, because there are naval bases, facilities, really scattered, I think, all around the country that no one knows are there. The Navy is that agency that really isn't supposed to, when you think about it, have much to do with anything outside the ocean. But they consider, and always have, space to be their ocean as well. And they are extremely active in outer space.
Yes, they are. You know, it reminds me, Jeff, I met an individual outside of Nashville who told me about an experience he had that we could discuss another time, that it was also at a naval base that was in the desert.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I think
China
Lake is a naval facility out in the Mojave Desert, if I remember correctly. George, is China Lake Navy? It is, isn't it?
What was that?
No, is China Lake Navy? I think so,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's another one.
So,
what's a naval base doing in the middle of the desert? There's another one, a big naval operation up at, I don't know, big in terms of thousands of people, but it's a very important facility up in Idaho, in Lake Panderai, I think that's how you pronounce it. And they do a lot of submarine sorts of work there. It's, I think, a secret facility. People know it's there, but they do secret work. Okay, why don't you go ahead and introduce Dan to us, Frank, and we'll get into this story. I'm really looking forward to this.
Thank you, Jeff. And Dan, it's a pleasure to be able to have you on Jeff's show to share your story with a very eager public. You've had three extraordinary experiences, and thank you for this willingness to come forward and share it this evening.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. Very good. Up here in the cold northeast up here, but spring is breaking. Slowly the geese are starting to fly, but things are straightening out. Spring is coming.
They're flying. They're not frozen?
No. They were frozen for quite a while, but the river broke. The ice is gone, so that was a blessing. I'm right on the river here in northeast Pennsylvania.
I'm on the west coast in Oregon, and we didn't have winter this year. It just didn't happen. It stayed in the 40s and 50s.
We definitely did, so I think we took your winter away from
you.
No,
you stole it all, and you're welcome to it.
Yep.
What, do you remember, this is a fun question, Frank. Oh, I'll ask Frank. Frank, what did you have for dinner when you met Dan?
Oh, my gosh, the lady who had us for dinner, I could go into detail about it. We had an excellent dinner and fine wine and great conversation afterwards, and it was just a wonderful evening.
Yeah, I know.
She
you
made a beautiful
see?
Roast.
What
she
did
made
she
a
make?
Beautiful roast. A beautiful roast.
A roast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you have enough wine, and everything looks like a roast, so we'll take your word for that. All right, Dan, step right up and let's talk. What your dad was in the Navy in World War II?
Yes, my dad was a Navy man in World War II. So I was getting out of high school, 1968. Vietnam was pretty heavy. My dad, being a Navy man, he said, "You better get down and joined the Navy," because I was A1 all the way and passed the physical and everything else. So they were looking for a few good men, you know, at that time.
They're looking for about 65,000 that never came home, unfortunately.
Right. That's the sad part right there. So I went down and joined and passed the flying colors. And next thing I knew, I was heading to the Great Lakes. And did my boot camp in the Great Lakes. And then I went to Jacksonville, Florida.
Uh-huh.
The big base there, and I was supposed to be training for ordnance men there. And I went to work the first day. I was there 3 days. The first day I went on a Monday to work, and they said, "Well, they said you're not supposed to be here." And I said, "Well, where am I supposed to be?" And they said, "Pinecastle." And I said, "Well, what's Pinecastle?" And they said, "We don't know what Pinecastle is." And I said, "Well, this is really good. What do I do now?" They said, "You just go get all your clothes, throw them in your ditty bag, and get down here and sit until somebody comes and asks you that you're going to Pinecastle." So that's what I did. So
Pinecastle Electronic Warfare Range. That's, for all of you listening, Pinecastle, about 90 miles south of Jacksonville. So it wasn't an hour and a half away, something like that.
Yep. And and it's on just off of Route 19 and 40 in the Ocala National Forest, about 1 mile from that intersection.
I bet it's beautiful there.
And it was a nice place, but you had to watch out for the rattlesnakes and the scorpions.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And you couldn't kill any of that because you were in the Ocala National Forest. You weren't supposed to be killing that stuff.
Oh, is that true? You're supposed to be bitten and
die? Yeah, they let you hunt deer and stuff, but they were a little... They didn't like you to kill stuff like that, but people did. They first day of deer season, there was more big rattlesnakes on the poles than there was deer, so... It was unbelievable how many rattlesnakes.
Now they have, I guess, anacondas and boas. A lot of tropical snakes are thriving down there.
Yeah, people let everything go down there. And just like the jungle, everything will live down there. It's warm.
Yeah. Well, most of the snakes we have out here are two-legged, so we're kind of lucky. You can see those coming. They don't hide too well. All right, so you're at this... Pine Castle facility.
Pine Castle Electronic Warfare Range.
And you don't know what how you got sent there or anything. You just following directions.
No, I just following orders like a good, sailor would do.
Sure.
Now, it was a small base. It was only about 80 people in the whole base. Most of them lived off base.
Uh-huh.
Once they folded up second shift that night, usually then everybody would, majority of the people would go home except for the single guys that lived in the barracks. And it was like five parts of the base, and the main base had your living quarters and your dining room and stuff, and there was the air traffic control right next to that.
Okay, so you had an airstrip there. That's what we wanted to get to, yeah.
No,
okay.
We had no airstrip.
We had a helicopter pad.
That was it. We had one ship we had out in Lake George, Florida. And that was dropping flares. So a lot of times people see stuff like that, and a lot of them is flares from Lake George.
Because
there's a ship out there that the Navy drops at night on.
I see.
And we have a target area where you had all your live ordnance and inert ordnance and rockets. And missiles were fired there. We had a big, big range out there with all Star David and the main bull, and we dropped simulated nuclear bombs and everything else out there.
You mean in the ocean?
No, right in the middle of the forest. That was 6 miles from the main base.
Really?
So the main complex, like I said, had the barracks, the main control tower, and then they had an MSQ-44 radar, which later on, after I went through all the other basic stuff that I had to go through there, I ended up striking. I got out of the ordnance business and went into the radar business.
What kind of aircraft were firing on the firing range?
Well, we had Marines come in there. We had Navy come in there, F-4s, A-4s. F-4 Phantoms, A-5 Vigilantes would come over and do reconnaissance and flashing and taking pictures.
Interesting.
And what the base did was, it was electronic warfare range, so they'd be able to simulate all the... you would come in and maybe drop your live ordnance at the same time. There was different radars out there and different electronic stuff that they had through the whole area. And the Centroid was another part of electronic area. And they would shoot simulated missiles at you. And then that would show whether or not the plane was knocked down, or we killed them, or their gear was good enough.
I got it.
That they would get away from the missiles and turn right around and get their bombs off and then go back home.
Okay.
And when they got back home, they'd be able to get a debriefing on the whole thing electronically.
All right. So
they knew what they should do, and that's how they learned is, I got shot, but it was only, simulated that they got
shot.
It doesn't
hurt that way. I got you. Okay.
And it shows how their gear worked and how our gear worked. So
now, tell us about this first event with the F-4, I guess. You had two F-4 Phantoms on call. At Jacksonville.
Okay, well, after I got into the Navy side, because I had to do a lot of other stuff before that, and I say I quit the ordnance side because I almost got killed out there. A few of my friends got blown up, and I said that's not the way to go. So I went and went on the billet for training devicemen is what they called them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was in the radar van. And so I went up for that test and passed it, so I started to work in the radar van. I got a secret clearance, and things were pretty well just normal routine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Until one day we got called in the office and had a debriefing, and they said that the people in this little town called Altoona, which was like 20, 30 miles from the base, but it was in our range that we had. There was a flying perimeter that they had.
It was in your airspace.
Yeah, in the airspace. Thank you. I couldn't think exactly what it was. It was in our airspace. And so we were taking the slack and all the blame on this because the people would see this object come out in the evening in the dark, and it would come out of one of the lakes down there, just out of Altoona.
What, a light?
They would see an object come out. Whether they were seeing a light, they were mostly seeing like an object. They could see it, but they couldn't figure out what it was. So we were getting all the blame. And I mean everybody in that town. It was a small town.
Uh-huh.
I mean ministers and the police department there. And so they called their senators and representatives. And that all flowed back downhill, and they wanted to know what we were doing to scare the people in the town.
Huh.
And we said, we're not doing anything out of the ordinary. And they said, well, you got to do something because these people are complaining, and now all the bigwigs are on us. So I said they called on a special mission.
Mm-hmm.
So I was picked. They picked a handful, few people,
mm-hmm.
and they knew it always came up in the evening. So I was one of them that was picked to run to do the plotting and talk to the pilots. And
Excuse me, Dan, this object that came up, was it recognizable as a piece of hardware, do you know? Do you remember? Or did the people just see it as a light that came up?
No, all they could see was a shape of something in the air.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then they said after a bit it would go, and they couldn't see it anymore when it got dark, but they knew there was something there, and they couldn't mm-hmm. tell what it was. But
weird.
So
it would rise up and just kind of hover?
It would come out of the lake and hover there.
Oh, all right. All right. So you got your two F-4s, and you're going to call them in for help?
Oh, yeah. So we set it up. So I would call Jacksonville when the bogey popped up out of there. We send a radio truck down by the lake.
Uh-huh.
So if he saw it first,
you knew which. Excuse me, Dan. You knew which lake it was. Did you have the lake nailed down?
Yeah, we knew exactly about where it was because they had a big water tower. And Altoona was just sat to the left of the water tower.
Okay. Would your radar reach that far?
Our radar would go 120 miles circumference. We go 60, 70 miles out into the ocean both sides.
So did you ever track that bogey before this time? Were you able to?
No, we never. Nobody ever saw anything of that.
Huh.
What we probably thought it was just probably trash or some cloud or...
Uh-huh.
It was just a normal blip
uh-huh.
on the screen.
Okay.
And like I said, it was close to that water tower, which when we tracked other planes, we always knew where that water tower was.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was a stationary object, one of many. So we were watching in the radar. We saw it pop up. Then the radar man that we sent with the radar truck, he called. I said, don't worry, we got him. And by then, I was on the phone calling Jacksonville. So Jacksonville, they had two pilots down there with two F-4 Phantoms, which was very fast,
uh-huh.
very powerful planes at that time, some of the best. And they scrambled those jets. And it wasn't even, I don't think 5 minutes before they got up. Jax was about 90 miles from us. 5-10 minutes, we picked them up on our radar screen, but we locked on to the object, the bogey, and over the lake. And I'm talking to the guys as soon as they come in. So they came right on down, right down about almost even with Route 19 into Altoona.
So you're talking to pilots as they're coming in?
I'm talking to the pilots.
As they're closing, okay.
Uh-huh. So everything is being recorded all the way down the line. I uh-huh. have a big chart there in front of me. I have exactly where I'm at in the radar van,
uh-huh.
where this object is. I got a whole digital radar system. Now, the digital radar system was just put in. It was the first digital radar tracking system that was ever put in for the Navy and this type of radar.
All right. So the two F-4s, you got the two F-4s, and they're coming in. And what are the pilots and you talking about?
We're talking about I'm directing them in to where they're at, and I also warned them about the tower because I didn't know exactly the height of that, but this bogey wasn't far over the trees.
Uh-huh.
And turned right around, and they said, well, we're lowering our gear, so they put their flaps down and their airspeeds down. And the air breaks down, and they were coming in to slow it down as slow as they could.
Huh.
So they all of a sudden they said, and every time they said something, it was on the voice recorder, and I was also marking it down on the pen on the wall. I got a big chart.
Uh huh.
In this, and every time that we were tracking this, it was. It was plotting the whole thing out, so I just keep marking every time. So they said something, I make sure you know what it said. So
got it. Understand.
So they came into it and they said we have a positive lock, and they said I said yep, so do we.
Is that a radar lock or a visual?
No, they had a positive lock on radar on the two F-4s.
Uh huh.
We had positive lock, and there was probably five or six other radars that we had. We had some that was like SAMSite radars, and we had some up at the Centroid. We had two, three radars, and they had locks on them, too.
Okay, all right.
So there was a few radars that was locked on this.
You got it covered, all right. And so these guys are coming in.
They were trying to slow down as slow as they could because the object wasn't moving. So then I saw my pen move a little bit, but sometimes you get some noise off the pots or something, but we had it all calibrated good.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally my digital read off of them started to show some speed. So I'm showing it's starting to move, so I tell them, be advised, it's starting to move at a slow speed. So they were coming up on it, and as they came up on it, the bogey, and you want to call it UFO bogey, whatever it was, it started to pick up the same speed. And it kept that distance, the same distance.
Kept in
if
front of them.
It was doing 200 miles an hour. It started to do 200 miles an hour.
Ah, how close did they get to it?
It was not closing on it. It was just like it started to go, and it kept the same distance.
Got it. How close did they get to it at approximately? What was their closest?
They could see it, and they never did say what exactly it would look like, but they could see it.
They did have visual contact also.
They got a visual on it. They had it on radar.
Okay.
And they could not close the distance. It's just like it was making a mocking of them. It was just doing the same speed. If it was, and the speeds were picking up because I could see all this on the digital readouts.
Sure.
So turn right around.
We're going to go through the break, Todd. Keep going, Dan.
Okay. So it turned right around, and we're up to a couple hundred miles an hour. And no time at all. And then all of a sudden they said, well, the two pilots says, okay, let's see what this thing is made out of. We're going to hit the afterburners.
Ah.
And I marked that down, going to hit the afterburners.
Mm-hmm.
And they hit the afterburners. And now you're talking they're going to kick up to 600, you know, 700 miles an hour. Well, this thing hit their afterburners.
Well, whatever they had, yeah. So the object just...
The next thing I know... My pen started to go across the whole board like it just shot across the board. Now, my tracking radar is on top of this van.
Uh-huh.
And the van is tied down with chains. And I'm like up on a hill, up on blocks, on a high pedestal thing that they made for it.
Yeah.
That whole van just shook. And I mean, I never felt that van. The tracking radar spun so hard. Now, how it's... stayed with them was beyond my belief. But the next thing I know, instead of being in Central Florida, it was in the ocean, Daytona somewhere. Just like clicking your fingers. And then the pilot says, he said some like four little words.
Uh-huh.
One pilot said to the other, he said, did you see that bleep bleep and go? And then he says, told us, he says, this is way out of our league. We're going home.
Really?
And it went so fast. Like I said, the radar just totally shook, and I thought the track antenna on top of it was, I thought maybe it even fell off. I had somebody go up and look, see if it was all right.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now
we did not lose the bird. Everybody else called in, started to call in, Dan.
Uh-huh.
They said we lost it. We lost all the little, some of the little radars were down too low, and that's why they lost it, too. Once it moved fast, they couldn't keep up. But since our height was so high, we had the best advantage from the height-wise.
Uh-huh.
So we kept up, and they went out into the Atlantic Ocean there. And then they went into a cloud. And everybody said they lost it, so I left all the people go offline. Everything was still being recorded.
Now, you're talking about the F-4s went into a cloud or the object?
Oh, the object went into clouds. The F-4s said they were going home. It was out of their league that there was nothing they could do. They were just so amazed at the speed that it left them. It was just like a blink of the eye. They were from Central Florida to that would be like 60 miles from where they were.
Got it.
They were out in the ocean in 60 miles, like click of your fingers. Just like that, they were gone.
Wow. Any idea how large the object was?
They said it was those guys just said when they had an object in there, they could see it. And like I said, after that, they never got a good visual on it because they kept that same speed.
I see.
No matter how they tried to catch up with them, the same distance was always there. But when they tried to catch them with the afterburners, then they just made us look so bad, it was unbelievable. Because there was nothing we had that would do that speed.
Right. Wow, that's wild.
Jeff, can I interject something here?
Yeah.
Dan, would you share with Jeff and his audience what you estimated that speed to be, that it was out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in that snap of a finger?
Well, later on, if I have to go into the story, what happens after I go into the ocean before I can tell you the speed, because I didn't really look down at the speed then, and I didn't push the button to lock in all the readings.
Okay. All right, I'll let you
go. It was just out there then, and then he was out there in the ocean.
All right, go ahead, Dan.
And now the guy says in the back, we have men working on the big visual screen and they're running the dials on the elevation and the azimuth to get them in there. And it says, we locked my, and I told the guys, I says, just hold the position where they're at because everybody else lost them. I can go from where I'm at my tracking station on the board. Mm-hmm. I could just walk right around and see what they're doing. And I said, where'd you lose them? They said, in that cloud, when it hit the cloud. I said, told them, I says, well, I says, I think they're in the cloud. What made me think they were in the cloud? And I said, I think they stopped in the cloud. I said, did you see anything come true? He said, no, but we weren't looking because there was a couple layers of clouds out in the ocean. So I says, okay, unlock the radar. And I says, turn your elevation down to the ground. Now their tracking radar is not pointing at them, so they don't have the signal.
Okay.
Out he pops back out. And they said, how did you know that? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't know why I think I know what these guys are doing because I think they're almost feeding me information. I says, but I said, I knew they were in that cloud.
So the object came and whatever crewmen or operators were in it came out of that cloud as soon as you changed that radar.
As soon as we took the tracking thing off them, the signal wasn't there because we put it back onto the ground.
Yeah.
And we just followed the cloud slowly. As the cloud went slow, we kept, I said, stay right on that one little puff there, that cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved left. It was going, I think, south, the clouds were. So we just was moving the radar south, but
uh-huh.
never put the tracking elevation on them and never locked on them. So when they popped out, then we came back up and we locked on them. Well, the funny thing of it is when you have looking at all the your azimuth and your elevation, I don't know if you know anybody read it, it's like a green circle with a little gate in the middle.
Uh-huh.
And a green circle with a little gate. And when you have an object locked in, you get a blip in that gate.
Gotcha.
Well, they threw the gear at us. They were actually starting to throw gear at us and gave a big blip and was throwing our radar back and forth.
What do you mean they threw gear at you?
They had gear just like we have gear. One like a pilot is being locked on by a.
So they were locking on your radar. They
threw gear at us to show our radar off.
Oh.
They were playing games with us. They were little playing games with us.
That must have been amazing.
And it was like a mind game. When I said, okay, I says, what do I do now? So I told the guys, I said, okay. I says, break off them again because their signal's stronger than what our signal is. He's going to throw us off. I says, you see a visual. Don't lose the visual. Put it back, tracking back to the ground.
Uh-huh.
So as soon as we did that, then here they come again. And now they're coming, and they started to come at us at a slow speed, and they're coming. So I go over there on the other side. I said, lock back on them. So they didn't play that game anymore with the blip in there, trying to take our signal off the radar.
Uh-huh.
They're coming at us. I go out there with the protractor and the ruler, and I'm seeing after they're going a little ways, they're picking up speed. They're up to a couple hundred miles an hour, and all of a sudden they're faster and faster, and I projected where they're going. I said, guys, I says, they're coming right down our throat. I said, they're aiming right at us. So here they come. Now the digital readout, like I said, it's all digital, was yellow. And the numbers started to spin on one end of it, 5 miles, 10 miles, 50 miles, 100 miles, to where you couldn't see the figures. It was changing so fast.
The speed. This is the airspeed of the object.
And you could feel the track. They're moving real fast, coming up over, and he started to come out. They closed in that 60 miles so fast, and that's when I hit the button. I said, guys, I'm going to lock the radar, so because you can't bring the tracking radar over, straight over, because if you do, it hits the stops, and it throws it down, and you could break.
Oh, yeah, I gotcha.
The whole thing, because there's cables and stuff in there. What the radar has to do, like if an object flies right over, it has to spin completely 360 degrees and pick you up on the other side.
Hmm.
And we couldn't do that. So now I hit the button to lock to get all the readings. And when I was looking down at the readings and somebody came over, one of the other guys come over because there was three guys back there. It was on automatic lock. I said, come out. I asked them, come out and look at these readings to verify it. And they said, I can't see the readings. I said, that's right. That's what I want you to verify. The numbers are moving so fast. So I hit the button, and the readings come out. And when I told this to Frank, and the more I thought about it, I knew I was right, but I was ashamed to tell everybody the number because they thought I was going to maybe I did flip my cookie or something, you know. It was 22,000 miles an hour he came at us.
22,000
miles an hour. Like a Mach speed of almost 30.
He came out of that cloud and just stepped on it and came right
at
you.
And he started to go. That radar was just, you could just feel that track moving and coming. And I said, I got to do it now because it's going to hit our stops. And I don't think we got any false readings because, as I say, everything was brand new at that time.
Fascinating.
And there was two doors that you can open up and listen. As soon as I told them to unlock it, both guys looked out both windows. They wanted to see what it was. They couldn't see nothing, and they couldn't hear nothing. So at that time, they told us, like I said, the one guy was over me. He said, I was told to take all this paperwork, all these tapes, and don't say nothing to nobody till they get back with us. So the mission was over. I mean, we sat there and just talked with each other, and he says, we just couldn't believe what just happened.
Well,
you know?
That's incredible. Yeah, yeah. So you had some visitors show up a couple of days later?
Well, it was a couple of days later, and like I said, we sat around and talked about it, and we all thought, well, you know, this will look good on our record, you know, because...
Uh-huh.
When you're going to go up for stripes or that extra, you know,
sure,
to help you gain an extra stripe or something, this will look good for you, you know, because you're the last three people that, you know, stayed with them and you did your mission and you did a real good one, everybody thought, you know.
So you thought you were going to be congratulated, okay.
Yeah, we thought we were going to get congratulated when we went into the commander's office. And, well, we went in there and I know the commander... quite a few years, he went away and he came back because he had a problem with sugar, and he went on a boat to do inspections out there, and time going from boat to boat, doing all the flags mm-hmm. and stuff that they did, the Navy did, mm-hmm. for all these inspections. That did his sugar in, so he had to have a desk job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's your CO, and what?
Oh, he's my CO for many years, and I knew him just to go in there, even to drink coffee with him.
Right.
And
that's
had
nice.
A lot of respect for him. He had a lot of respect for me. As soon as I walked in there, I looked at him. I said, easy to have an attack, you know, because he didn't look good.
Yeah.
He was quiet. Well, he wouldn't even say anything to me. They just told us to sit down on a wooden bench. So we sat down on that wooden bench. We sat there. There wasn't no word said for quite a while, a couple of minutes. And then in walked these two guys.
Okay, hold on right there, Dan. Okay. We have to take a short two-minute pause here, so three. We'll come right back. And we have about, 12 minutes to finish up. So
okay.
Get ready, and we'll come right back. You still there, George?
Yes, we're still here.
Yeah, well, you chased him and tracked him on radar, too. In the Air Force.
Right. Well, I was flying with them.
22,000 miles an hour. Wow.
We all clocked right. Some at 100,000.
Did you really? Oh, all right. Well, yeah. Hold on, gang. We'll be right back. Okay, let's get right back to our special guests talking to George Filer, Frank Chile, and Dan. Okay, Dan, you got him at Mach 28 or 29, something like that, 22,000 miles an hour. You were called into the CO's office and told to sit on the bench. You said he wasn't looking good, and you thought maybe
he was kind of pale.
Okay.
And I knew something was up. And these two guys walked in with the black suits, dark glasses. One guy had a suitcase strapped right to his hand with handcuffs. Walked up to the commander. It was Commander Forum at the time. And took the paperwork, and I could just see what he had. It was my paperwork, voice recorder, everything else. Locked it up, shook the commander's hand, turned to us, and walked up to point a finger at, I think I was the second guy, and the other guy stood right by us. I mean, he was inches from us, never said a word. Two of the tallest guys I ever seen. I don't know where they got him from. And turned right around, pointed a finger at us, says, you, and you. And there was four of us. Says, you don't know anything. You didn't see anything. You didn't do anything. He says, if you think you did, he said, we'll put you in a straitjacket right now, and you'll never see the light of day. He said, do you understand?
Holy cow.
And all you could say is, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, and yes, sir.
And these guys...
My Navy career after that.
Yeah, well, these guys were not Navy. They weren't in uniform. They were in black suits, and they had dark glasses on, I think you said. Were they wearing hats?
No. Not that I can remember.
Okay.
Yeah, they won mine. I can't remember for sure.
Well, that's a shocking event.
It was an experience that for 40 years, I didn't tell it until I met Frank. And for some reason, it seemed like he got it out of me, because at that time, I wanted to tell somebody. After 40 years, you want to tell somebody, and he seemed like I was relaxed with him, I guess.
You picked the right guy. That's really amazing. What did the CO do? And these guys walked out. They just walked out the door after that, right?
Walked out the door, and he said, you guys are dismissed, and never said another word to us, and he still didn't look well.
Wow. So
we thought, well, okay, this is it. And things went by for quite a while, and we had no incidents anymore. There was the people never saw this bogey anymore, and it went by for quite a few weeks. Went by till one day we out in our target area in the night. We put flare pots out, and one of the guys called up to the main base right there, and we were in the radar, and we have a system so nobody smashes up. You got to call Pinecastle Control, and then they go to Pinecastle Target. They drop their bombs, and then they go back to Pinecastle Control, and then they leave. So, you know, there's separation between the planes. So Pinecastle Target and Pinecastle Control don't know nothing, but the guys out in the Target supposed to know last asked Pinecastle Target, which supposed to know what's going on, who are these guys flying around on the flare pots, and why didn't you call us? Well, there were three, four of them. I think there was four of these little things flying around. And now the two guys in the control tower, they're fighting with each other because they thought they cleared airplanes in somebody's airspace and somebody, you know, wrecked that mid-air career, you know.
Yeah, sure.
So turn right around, and they said, the tower guys, the main guy said, there's nobody out there. There's nobody on the schedule for another hour. So turn right around, and one of the guys out in the tower, out there in the middle of the boonies now by himself with the only other guy a mile away from him in the other tower, so they get a cross-reference on the bomb, he says, step outside. And he says, tell me what you hear. And the other guy says, I don't hear nothing. He says, that's right. That's why I'm coming to get you. There was no noise. There was four of them diving on our target, on our flare pots. And they were smaller objects, and they with lights, and they were diving on the flare pots.
Well,
so
just
they told the guy,
just,
you can't come in. And the guy says, I don't care what you say. I don't care what order it is. I'm coming in. I'm leaving here. So there was 6 miles. They drove in. Them poor guys were full-grown guys. They were shaking. And they didn't want to go back out, and they didn't. They had to find somebody else, and they actually found guys to go out with 45s, and they asked me to go help them because I worked that target before, and I was checked out with a 45 because I ran payroll for a while.
Uh-huh.
And we had to go out with four guys instead of two with 45s, but I thought to myself, well, what good is that? I didn't have to go. I went back in the radar. And they had them locked on, too, on that radar, and then they just went very, very low in the trees, and we lost them.
So when you say they were diving on your flare pots, a flare pot is something dropped from an aircraft? It's a flare?
No, we just lit them ourselves.
Oh, they're on the ground?
Yeah, they were on the ground. They made a big circle,
uh-huh.
And then they drop in that circle, and then they get, when the flash of the bomb went off, one guy on one tower, the other tower, they would both swing their binoculars with X's in it and then read the two readings, and the guy in the main control would tell them where the bomb hit.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
And that's
so
how they did it.
Say they were diving on the flare pots, these objects, and they had lights on them.
They had their lights on. They had lights on them and everything else. They could see these objects. They thought it was our own planes. But we didn't have anybody for an hour. So it was just like, they're playing games with us very bad. So they disappeared. So, again, they went away for a while. And then there was one hop left one night. I don't know exactly what day it was. But everybody was just about done for the evening.
Uh-huh.
And we have a communications down in the barracks. The guy come on the radio there and called down. He says, guys, he says, I want you to come outside and see this. And I know who the guy was. His name was Louie. I didn't give any last names, but it was the air traffic controller.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Rosie, they were both air traffic controllers. We walked out because we were in the TV lounge. Most people were because everybody was settling in for the night. It was only one more hop. It was like 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked out, and you could see Louie on the up in the air traffic control tower, like 100 feet there, and this other guy on the rail. And here's this big orange disc over the top of the base. And it was the biggest thing I ever saw. And I said, well, we finally saw the mothership.
Wow.
And you had goosebumps on your goosebumps. And
it's just hovering
like
over the base.
A dozen guys that saw this.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if any of them saw it from the Centroid, how many was left over there, because I don't know when their missions were over with.
Yeah.
But it was a orange glowing disc, big. And it was about big enough to say, hard to compare size, but if it would have landed, it would have crushed our little base.
The whole base?
Yeah. I mean, you know, our base wasn't super big, but it would have crushed most of the base.
It's hundreds of feet in diameter, is what you're saying.
It was huge. It was huge.
And it was just sitting there motionless.
It was an orange glowy dull glow.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like it wasn't much change to it. There was no other lights. There was nothing beaming down at us, nothing.
Perfectly round.
Perfectly round.
But it was big. A disc. Okay.
Disc. It is orange disc.
And this sounds like, Frank Chile, it must have been several hundred yards across at least.
And more than that, Jeff, I sent you an aerial photograph of the base that he was at.
Oh, yeah, I got it.
And that's a base. And that dwarfed that base. Dan, tell him how long it was in sight.
It must have. We sat there and just looked. I mean, you couldn't. Nobody was even saying anything. You had guys around me and stuff. And it stayed there, I'd say, at least 5-10 minutes.
Okay, and I'm looking at this picture, and that's got to be a mile across, or damn close to it.
Yep.
It was huge. That's all I could say. It was hard to judge exactly what it, but you looked out and say, if you kept coming, you just had to think that it'd flatten you.
How high do you think it was above the tower? The guys were up on the top of the tower there.
We were looking, I was straight up at it, and it was a little bit angled off. I don't think it was 1,000 feet.
Oh, my. That's astounding.
I mean, it was close. I mean, you could actually, like I said, everybody you didn't know what to do. Then all of a sudden, as fast as it was there, it was like gone. Just like a blink, gone.
Could you see the direction it went?
No, you couldn't. It was just like when it was gone, it was like lights out, and the light that you were looking at, you know, like you changed lights in a room or something, you know, sure. Your eyes can't adjust fast enough or something.
Yeah.
It was just gone.
Oh, my.
And it was kind of funny because when a guy says, you see that thing go, and the guy sees that thing go, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I said to him, I said, guys, how do you know, and I really said this because I was a little card at that time. I said, how do you know he didn't shut the light off and he's still there coming down?
That's possible.
Well, every one of them guys went into that base, and I thought, I'm out there by myself. I see the other two guys in the tower. I says, what is that base going to do for you? You know? They had us. They made us look like fools. Everything that happened, they made us look so bad it was unbelievable.
It's just a remarkable thing.
Compete. Yeah. You can't even fathom what happened and how sophisticated and how fast these things move,
mm-hmm.
and what they're capable of.
And how big. And this is how many years ago? 40?
72, 73. It was about 40 years ago.
What a story.
Then I heard they had other episodes down there after that.
Uh-huh.
And like I said,
were you reprimanded? Dan, were you reprimanded after that third sighting?
No. Because we kept everything for ourselves after that point.
Oh, you didn't talk about the big orange disc.
Oh, we talked about the guys that was there, but we never went and reported.
I see.
No, not after what we went through. The reporting days was over with. I don't care what I seen from them. If they came down and shook my hand, was the green man, I wouldn't tell anybody. I wasn't going to be locked up at. No way.
Well, you don't mess with men in black. That's that's very, very amazing. George Feiler, step in here, and we don't have a lot of time, but real quick.
I'd like to point out that we still get reports from Ocala National Forest. I guess it was about 6 months ago, KT Frankovich called me and said that she had a small disc over her trailer in the Ocala National Forest.
Uh-huh.
It's just hovered there. And then she actually saw something that looked like a alien in the forest running, and she went after it with her dogs and stuff, but never was able to catch it. The point is that they're still around. I don't know if the big one's around, but smaller ones are certainly around. And I was just in St. Augustine, Florida, and the lady we were staying with also saw them.
Well, there's so much going on out there. That was a remarkable story. Anything, Dan, you want to add to it? We're over time here, but real quick, if you've got anything you want to add.
Well, like I always told the guys at work when the subject came up, I never told them what I did. I told them what I said. I know what I did. I said, I know what I saw, guys. I said, keep an open mind, because when you're finally going to find out the real truth and see this, and he always had one of these doubters. I had him at work.
Yeah.
I said, I just point to one guy. I said, he's probably going to die of a heart attack. I said, I don't want the rest of you guys to. I said, keep an open mind, because I said, we don't know nothing. And I said, we're going to have to find out the hard way, because I said, nobody, our government doesn't want to tell us what's really going on.
Well, that's for darn sure. Dan, thank you very much for coming on tonight and sharing those amazing events. That huge disc must have just ingrained itself into your DNA. You don't forget stuff like that. Nothing.
No, I never will.
Wow. Thank you
but
again.
I didn't want to take this to my grave and not tell anybody.
No.
And the older I got, which I'm up there now, health-wise, I'm not the best. I would like to tell somebody, and like I said, keep an open mind, people, because seeing is believing. And then when you work and have to do it and then just get crushed afterwards because you do a good job. That kind of ruined my career and everything else, so I'll let it go at that.
Well, what you've shared tonight is heroic, and we're more than grateful. And thank you very much, Dan.
Well, you're very welcome. All you guys are.
You're most appreciated. You take care. All right.
Okay, I'm signing off.
Okay, Dan. Good night.
Okay.
Frank, we have just a minute left. We got to run here, but just amazing. What a brave man. On many accounts, for being here tonight, for witnessing those things the way he did, and the advice he's given to others. Just really remarkable.
Right. A lot of people are coming forward.
Yeah.
I'm always happy to tell their story.
Anytime.
Try to get them in touch with you.
Anytime at all. Frank, anything you want to add? Okay, I think Frank may have checked out. Tell him thank you, George. Oh, no, there you are. Okay.
The size of that lake was 20 miles by 8 miles.
Wow. So you're projecting...
So he didn't get a chance to share that with you, but it was a huge lake.
Okay.
Right. A lot of times they hide under him.
Yeah, well, we know. We've talked about that before. Okay, Frank, thank you so much for bringing Dan on. That was amazing.
Pleasure.
Just a remarkable story.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk again soon, Frank. And, George, thank you, as always.
You're welcome.
Just let me know. I'm here. I'm just very, very happy to be able to share this material with people. As Dan said, keep an open mind, folks. Keep an open mind.
Well, they're out there. We're getting 1,000 reports a month.
Wow. Okay. All right, George, take care. Talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, that's hour number one, and we will be right back.